Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
All right. Good evening, everyone. A little bit of housekeeping. That QR code on there, those four, if you scan that with your phone, it will pull up a Google form questionnaire where you can submit questions or passages you would like me to specifically talk about in Deuteronomy, and I'm going to spend all of our last class in the series going through those, kind of addressing questions or talking about specific passages. That QR code will be at the beginning of every class, and then I'll also show it again at the end of the class. Before we get started with the actual lesson, let's start with a prayer. Lord, thank you so much for giving us the ability to come and learn about your word. Thank you for allowing us to live in a nation where we get to worship you freely and to live out our lives as Christians without fear. Lord, I pray that you help us to always reach out to the poor and the needy, to reach out to those who are lost with your light, and to always shine your light on this world. In your name I pray. Amen. Okay. So, welcome back to our series on Deuteronomy. For those who have not been coming to this class, we have had, I have a couple of objectives that I've been trying to meet for this series. And that's by, at the end of this, you will have a good understanding of Deuteronomy as a place to find ethical guidance or answers to spiritual questions, that you understand Deuteronomy's literary structure, the design patterns, and the central themes that are found throughout the book. And if nothing else, that you understand how the New Testament authors both interpreted and applied Deuteronomy's teachings in their writings. Now, to accomplish these objectives, we've spent the first two classes building a couple of tools that can help us as we go and read the text found in Deuteronomy. One of those tools that I kind of want to remind us is how we talked about the structure of Deuteronomy, right? We talked about the structure of Deuteronomy as being this ancient Near Eastern treaty style. And specifically, in our last class, we've spent a decent amount of time in the historical section, right, talking about how Moses describes the current relationship between God and Israel and God and humanity. And so last class, we spent a lot of time in the first chapter. In this class, we're going to be spending a lot of time in chapters 2 and 3. Now, what's interesting about this section is Moses goes into great detail about the different interactions Israel had with other nations during their time wandering through the wilderness. The other thing that's really interesting is Moses decides to not talk through that history in a chronological order. In fact, what he does instead is he breaks them up into two groups. He first talks about the nations that Israel did not conquer, and then he talks about the nations that they did conquer. And so, to begin, we will be talking about the nations that Israel did not conquer. So bear with me. I'm going to be reading chapter 2, verses 1 through 23. And that reads, "Then we turned and journeyed into the wilderness in the direction of the Red Sea, as Yahweh told me. And for many days we traveled around Mount Seir. Then Yahweh said to me, 'You have been traveling around this mountain country long enough. Turn northward and command the people. You are about to pass through the territory of your brothers, the people of Esau, who live in Seir, and they will be afraid of you, so be very careful. Do not contend with them, for I will not give you any of their land, no, not so much as for the sole of the foot to tread on, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. You shall purchase food from them with money that you may eat, and you shall also buy water from them with money that you may drink. For Yahweh, your Elohim, has blessed you in all the work of your hands. He knows you're going through this great wilderness. These 40 years, Yahweh, your Elohim, has been with you. You have lacked nothing. So we went on, away from our brothers, the people of Esau, who live in Seir, away from the Araba road from Alath and Ezion-Geber. And we turned and went in the direction of the wilderness of Moab. And Yahweh said to me, do not harass Moab or contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land for a possession, because I have given Ar to the people of Lot for a possession. The Amim formerly lived there, a people great and many and tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they are also counted as Rephaim, but the Moabites called them Amim. The Horites who lived in Seir formerly, but the people of Esau disposed them and destroyed them before them and settled in their place, as Israel did to the land of their possession, which Yahweh gave to them. Now rise up and go over the brook Zered. So we went over the brook Zered, and the time from our leaving Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the brook Zered was 38 years, until the entire generation, that is, the men of war, had perished from the camp, as Yahweh had sworn to them. For indeed the hand of Yahweh was against them, to destroy them from the camp until they had perished. So as soon as all the men of war had perished and were dead from among the people, Yahweh said to me, today you are to cross the border of Moab at Ar. And when you approach the territory of the people of Ammon, do not harass them or contend with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as a possession. Because I have given it to the sons of Lot for a possession. It is also counted as a land of Rephaim. Rephaim formerly lived there. But the Ammonites called them Zamzamim, a people great and many and tall as the Anakim. But Yahweh destroyed them before the Ammonites, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, as he did for the people of Esau who live in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites before them. And they dispossessed them and settled in their place even to this day. As for the Avim, who lived in villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim, who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and settled in their place. Okay. That was a lot, and oftentimes can be quite boring. But there's a couple of interesting things there that we can gather. The first that you might have recognized is that all the nations that they kind of interacted with were their distant relatives, right? They were the descendants of Lot and the descendants of Esau, right? These people that were either, right, Lot was the nephew of Abraham, or Esau, who was literally a direct descendant of Abraham. Now that's interesting, but that doesn't seem to be the main thrust, I would say, of the passage. A lot of the passage is dedicated to talking about how God had given them that land, and specifically about how God had helped them take over the land against these different types of giants, right? The Amim, the Rephaim, the Anakim, right? The very thing that made Israel afraid in the first place, right? The same thing that Israel was supposed to do in the first generation, but when they were faced with the giants, they were too scared to go into. So I would say that on a historical note, right, when Moses is first talking to this new generation, you can imagine that a lot of this was Moses trying to comfort them and encourage them, right? This new generation is supposed to go into the land now and conquer the giants. And so Moses is telling them, this is not God's first rodeo doing this. Right? Don't be like that first generation who was afraid of the giants. God has already done this a few times now, so it should just go well with you as well. However, that doesn't quite answer the reason why the Deuteronomy author decided to put this in. Right? How does this tell us about the relationship between God and Israel going forward as well, or between God and humanity? And there are a couple of things that we can kind of gather. The first is that this promise that God made to give them the land, right, this great thing that God was going to do for them, is not unique, apparently. that's not something that makes their relationship with God unique in any way. God has done that with many nations and will continue to do that with many nations. And I think, one, that's very important for the later Israelites to read, right? If you remember your Israelite history, eventually they are conquered by Babylon and taken into captivity. And so if it was the land that made their relationship with God unique, that would be something that they would have lost. But instead, as readers, they would have come to this and had to ask themselves, well, then what does make my relationship with God unique if it isn't this land that he's given us, if it wasn't this conquest that we went on? And I think as modern readers, I think that should also make us pause and ask the question, what is it about my relationship with God that is unique as a Christian? What is really the difference between my relationship with God versus his relationship with the rest of humanity that doesn't follow him and worship him as Christians? Now, I'll leave that there for you to ponder. We're going to be spending more time on that next week, especially as we start to look at chapter 4 of Deuteronomy. We're going to be talking more about that question. However, there is another related idea that we can grasp on here, and that's this idea of sovereignty. What Moses is saying here is that God makes nations rise and become conquerors, but also makes nations to fall and to be conquered. That he is actively arranging the nations and giving them the places, the times, and the borders that they get to exist. Right? Whether that's America, Germany, China, what Moses is saying here is that God is governing all of that. And I think of no one who kind of puts it more succinctly and as eloquently than Paul does, right? So in Acts chapter 17, when Paul shows up to Athens and he starts talking to the men of Athens, he goes on this long speech about the unknown God that they seem to worship in verses 22 and following. And in verse 26, he makes this interesting statement. And he being God, made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. Right? That is exactly what Moses is saying here, right? Is that God is in control of which nations exist at any moment in time and where their boundaries lie. Now, I'll say this. I don't think that's a quite unorthodox thing to say anymore. Right? That's a fairly belief that Christians hold true. If a non-Christian hears that, that's not something that kind of catches them off guard. However, at the time of writing, this was a very radical statement that Moses is making. So in the ancient Near Eastern world, they had a very different belief about spirituality and nations and all of this. Right? Their belief was that there were many gods, some associated with specific nations, or gods associated with specific lands, right? You can think of the Egyptians' gods, right? They had the god of the Nile, but they also had Ra, the sun god, which was their god, right? The god of Egypt. And so what their belief was is that when nations went to war with each other, when they went to battle, it wasn't just the people, it was these gods battling. And the winner was the most powerful god. So what Moses is saying here is extremely contrary to that belief, right? He is saying that, no, that's not how that happens. God, our God, Yahweh, is the one who is deciding every nation, when they exist, when they don't exist, when they have land, when they don't have land. And that again becomes really important. It becomes a really big sticking point for God and the prophets moving forward, especially when Israel gets conquered, right? Because under this ancient Near Eastern belief, they would say that Yahweh was a less powerful God than the Babylonian gods. But the prophets and Moses make this very big claim is that that's not what happens. What happens is God decided that Israel was no longer fit to be a nation and needed to be conquered. And I think that can sometimes make us feel uncomfortable, right? I think a lot of us are very comfortable with the idea of God creating nations, making them rise, putting specific leaders in place of those nations, right? Paul talks about that in Romans 13. But that inverse idea, that God would cause an empire to fall, that God would actively cause a nation to be conquered, to lose a war, that can sometimes make us feel uncomfortable. And that is the exact question that Moses then deals with this next section of Deuteronomy we're going to read. So I'm going to read Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 24 through 3:11. And that reads, "Rise up, set out on your journey, and go over the valley of the Arnon. Behold, I have given into your hand Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his land. Begin to take possession and contend with him in battle. This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you and on the peoples who are under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you. So I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemoth to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, with words of peace, saying, 'Let me pass through your land. I will go only by the road. I will turn aside neither to the right nor to the left. You shall sell me food for money that I may eat, and give me water for money that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot. As the sons of Esau who live in Seir and the Moabites who live in Ar did for me, until I go over the Jordan into the land that Yahweh, our Elohim, is giving to us.' But Sihon, the king of Heshbon, would not let us pass by him. For Yahweh, your Elohim, hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate, that he might give him into your hand as he is this day. And Yahweh said to me, 'Behold, I have begun to give Sihon and his land over to you. Begin to take possession that you may occupy his land.' Then Sihon came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Jahaz. And Yahweh, our Elohim, gave him over to us, and we defeated him and his sons and all his people. And we captured all his cities at that time and devoted to destruction every city, men, women, and children. We left no survivors. Only the livestock we took as spoil for ourselves, with the plunder of the cities that we captured. From Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, and from the city that is in the valley as far as Gilead, there was not a city too high for us. Yahweh, our Elohim, gave all into our hands. Only to the land of the sons of Ammon you did not draw near, that is, to all the banks of the river Jabbok and the cities of the hill country, whatever Yahweh, our Elohim, had forbidden us. Then we turned and went up the way to Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. But Yahweh said to me, 'Do not fear him, for I have given him and all his people and his land into your hand. And you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon.' So Yahweh, our Elohim, gave into our hand Og also, the king of Bashan, and all his people. And we struck him down until he had no survivor left. And we took all his cities at that time. There was not a city that we did not take from them. 60 cities, the whole region of Argob, the kingdom of Og in Bashan. All these were cities fortified with high walls, gates, and bars, besides very many unwalled villages, and we devoted them to destruction, as we did to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, devoting to destruction every city, men, women, and children. But all the livestock and the spoil of the cities we took as our plunder. So we took the land at that time out of the hand of the two kings of the Amorites, who were beyond the Jordan, from the valley of the Arnon to Mount Hermon. The Sidonians call Hermon Sirion, while the Amorites call it Seir. All the cities of the tableland and all Gilead and all Bashan as far as Salakai and Edrei, cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan. For only Og, the king of Bashan was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. Behold, his bed was a bed of iron. Is it not in Rabbah of the Ammonites? 9 cubits was its length, and 4 cubits its breadth, according to the common cubit. All right. So I mentioned sometimes this passage can make us feel uncomfortable, queasy, however you might say it. And I think it's specifically this phrase, right? Right, chapter 3, verse 6, and we devoted them to destruction. Devoting to destruction every city, men, women, and children. And I think usually the core question that I think people end up really phrasing is, all of them? All of them had to die? Every one of them? Like, I can understand, right? Murderers, rapists, pedophiles, however you might want to say it. But all of them, including the children, the ones who did not yet know right from wrong, every one of them? And on the surface, it even feels a little arbitrary, so to speak. Right? Why would it not be Lot and Esau that they would take over? Why did it have to be the Amorites? Right? These two kings. Right? If you go back to Numbers, the descendants of Lot and Esau did not treat them kindly. I mean, Lot literally comes up and wants to go to war, but Israel just doesn't fight them. When they're dealing with Moab and they're walking through the land, the king of Moab literally sits there and curses them as much as he can as they're going through. And honestly, even at like a practical level, why not Egypt? Right? Why did they not just conquer Egypt? They were right there. God already wiped out most of the army. A decent amount of Egyptians actually became Israelites in Exodus. So why these people? And I think a lot of it comes about mainly because of how the Old Testament authors like to write. So they write with a very specific assumption in mind, which is that you are a lifelong reader, right? That you are going to read and reread the story of the Old Testament and the Bible over and over and over again, that you are going to meditate on these passages day and night. That is what they believe about the reader. And specifically, they'll often believe that, oh, you're reading Deuteronomy. That means you should have read Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. Not only should you have read it, you should probably have a decent memory of what has happened, and you should probably already understand what has been taught in those books. And so they usually don't have this feeling of having to have a deep explanation of what's going on. A lot of the ideas and specific nuances that they expect the reader to understand, they don't go into detail. Rather, they use what some scholars refer to as hyperlinks, right? If you think about a Wikipedia page, right, you're reading a Wiki page, and there are specific phrases or words that are those blue highlights that you can click on, and then you'll jump to a new page. That's usually how the Old Testament authors like to write. They'll leave these phrases in there. They'll weave them in to try and jog your memory of specific stories that you're expected to remember and go back to. Right. We already talked about this once, right? In the previous lesson, we talked about how in chapter 1, Moses uses that phrase that Israel is as numerous as the stars of heaven, which was a specific phrase taken from Genesis 15. Right? It's that hyperlink that brought us over there, where God specifically promises to Israel that they would be as numerous as the stars of heaven. And so to go beyond that, the surface reading of Deuteronomy 2, to understand why it was the Amorites, we're going to do a little bit of going through some hyperlinks, going down some rabbit trails, per se. Now, the first one that I want to kind of walk through is these giants, right? So in Deuteronomy 2 and 3, they keep mentioning these very specific races of people, the Anakites, the Emites, the Rephaim, and they're all kind of under these umbrella of what they would call the Rephites. And when you first read Deuteronomy, or at least when I first read Deuteronomy and didn't really know any of this, my first instinct was really to go, who? am I supposed to know these people? Am I supposed to care? And the answer is yes, and yes, you should know these people, and you should care if you've been reading and paying attention. If we go back to Numbers chapter 13, right, the original story of when Israel refuses to go into the land, which has already been talked about a lot in Deuteronomy and should be kind of fresh in our minds reading this, in verses 31 through 33, we get this passage. The men, the spies who come in, they give this report. Then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are." So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land and that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we had gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seem to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seem to them." So this is where that first hyperlink brings us. And then again, I find myself asking the question, who? Am I supposed to know who the Nephilim are? Am I supposed to care? Is this important? And the answer is yes. You are supposed to know who they are. If you've been reading and paying attention, you would know who these people are because they show up in Genesis chapter 6 in a very important way. So we go over to Genesis chapter 6. We can read verses 1 through 4. And this should be somewhat familiar. "When man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive. And they took as their wives any they chose. Then Yahweh said, 'My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown.'" And in verse 5 we get, "Yahweh saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." So, what we find is who the Nephilim are, where they come from, is these beings called the sons of God, and these beings called the daughters of man, mate, and they produce these giants called the Nephilim, who we are told are the great warriors of old, right? The men of renown that you hear about all the time. Now, people write books and dissertations and debate who the sons of God are and how the Nephilim end up on both sides of the flood somehow, right? Even the author tells us that, hey, the Nephilim were here in these days during the flood and also afterwards after the flood. What I will say is, it doesn't really matter. It's an interesting question. If you care about it, I will point you to books and dissertations and all those things. You can go read about it. But literary-wise, right, for what we care about, doesn't matter who those beings are. What matters is there are these beings called the Nephilim that are considered giants that Deuteronomy, at least, identifies as being these kings, these specific kings of different nations. And Genesis identifies as being the core source of this evil in the world, and the systematic corruption and oppression that they find throughout, that causes God to come in and say, "I have to wipe them out. I can't just let them be there." And so, by following those hyperlinks, we can come to the very first reason why God chooses the Amorites and why Lot and Esau were given those specific nations to conquer as well. They were all led by these Nephilim, by these people that God identifies as being the source of just evil in the world that he feels the need to wipe out with Israel. So that's one reason. But you might ask then the question, well, those are the leaders, right? These very specific people. Why couldn't you just kill them and not the rest of them? These people that Deuteronomy identifies as Amorites, right? If you read 2 and 3, specifically in Sihon and Og, they are constantly identified as the king of the Amorites. King of the Amorites. These are Amorites. He says it multiple times to get your attention. And you would probably think, okay, who are the Amorites? Am I supposed to care again? And the answer is yes. And in fact, if you were paying attention in Genesis, and you were paying attention that first time that Moses reminds us of Genesis chapter 15, back in chapter 1, you would remember verses 12 through 16 in Genesis chapter 15, which says this: "As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram. And behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then Yahweh said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your offspring will be foreigners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there. And they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve. And afterward, they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete.'" So, God identifies to Abraham that the reason him and his immediate family could not just have the land as it is right now was because the Amorites, their iniquity was not yet complete, right? Which implies that for some reason, the Amorites had not crossed some kind of threshold of evil that God has put on them, right? They were not sinful enough, right? They weren't quite corrupt enough for him to deem that he needed to wipe them out. And this makes a very important point about the Amorites and why it was this nation, right? A lot of times when readers read about these passages of Israel conquering people, I think what they usually have in mind is some arbitrary nation that feels innocent and isn't really doing anything, kind of like a Switzerland, right? It seems arbitrary a little bit. But the Bible is very clear, actually, that you aren't supposed to think of them as like a Switzerland. You're really supposed to think of them as like a Nazi Germany, as a nation that had become so corrupt and evil that for God, they could not exist on his creation anymore. That it was just too much, and he needed to wipe them out, and they couldn't exist. Now, I think the very obvious question that at least comes to my mind is, well, what is that threshold that God seems to have when he wants a nation to be conquered? Or at least one reason why that might be. And we actually do get a story explaining this. And it's only a couple of chapters over in Genesis. It's actually Genesis chapter 18. I don't think we really have time for me to read it. So I'll just kind of paraphrase. So in Genesis 18, God takes on a human form with a couple of other spiritual beings, and they're sitting there having a feast with Abraham. And Abraham looks over to this other spiritual being, and he says, "Should I tell Abraham what I'm about to go do to Sodom and Gomorrah? How I've heard about their sins, and I'm about to go wipe them out? Should I tell Abraham that?" Right, with Abraham sitting in front of him. And Abraham, like most of us, kind of perks up and says, "Are you really going to sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Are you really going to kill all of them?" And they have this back and forth, right, where Abraham goes, "Well, what if there are 50 righteous people in Sodom and Gomorrah? Would you kill them? Would you kill them all?" And God goes, "No, actually, I would spare that nation." And then Abraham goes again, "Okay, well, what if there are 45? And God goes, "Okay, well, no, I wouldn't. I'd spare them as well." And they kind of keep going back and forth until they eventually get to 10 for whatever reason. Now, one question you might have is, okay, well, one, that's interesting. Okay, God would spare them with 10 people. That's good to keep in mind. And then the other question is, well, what exactly is the sin that Sodom and Gomorrah is committing that God would come and feel the need to wipe them out? And we are actually given that answer in Ezekiel. Right? In Ezekiel chapter 16, is revealed to us exactly what Sodom and Gomorrah were doing when God decided he no longer could let them be a nation. In verse 49 and 50, it reads, "Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, but they did not aid the poor and needy. They were haughty and did an abomination before me, so I removed them when I saw it." Now, so we see the reason God comes there in the first place to kind of test them is they were a very rich, prosperous nation, and yet they refused to help the poor and needy among them. But then he goes there, and the people try to capture him and do something to him. It's not quite, it's fairly clear, but it doesn't come out and say it. But Lot is actually there, and Lot saves him from this, in which Peter identifies Lot as a righteous person for this in his letter in 1 Peter. And because of this, God actually takes Lot and brings him out of Sodom and Gomorrah, right, in Genesis 19, before he destroys Sodom and Gomorrah. And we actually see that idea repeat itself a couple of times throughout the Old Testament, right? Noah with the flood, right? Noah is saved from this righteous wiping out. Rahab, when Israel comes to wipe out Jericho, is spared and saved. And I think one thing that this story tells us and is meant to come to mind every time God goes to wipe out a nation is he takes the righteous, he brings them out to spare them, and then he wipes them out. And so I think, really, when you read that phrase, all men, women, and children, one, that feels more military rhetoric than anything. But two, what it really means is, I'm going to take these righteous people, I'll spare them, but the rest, they can't be in my creation anymore. There is too much evil, too much corruption, and too much oppression for me to let them survive. So, kind of summarize everything we've talked about today. We talked about how God is the author of nations, right? He is fully sovereign. He has nations rise, become conquerors, and he has them fall and become conquered. And one of the reasons why nations fall is when God deems them so evil, so corrupt, so oppressive, that he can't let them be in his creation anymore and decides they need to be wiped out. And so next week, we're going to be looking at Deuteronomy chapter 4, talking about more about God's relationship with Israel and humanity, and specifically talking about that question of what makes Israel's relationship unique compared to the rest of the world, and thinking a little bit more about our relationship, right, as Christians, and what makes our relationship unique. And then we'll start getting into the stipulations in chapter 5. But until then, if you have questions, scan the QR code, and I hope you have a good week. Thank you.